Thank you very much, Frank Wilcox, for that very thoughtful eulogy. That's it. That was so good, it was hard to swallow. Thank you very much. It's great to be here with all of you, Mark and Abby, to join with your other friends and paying tribute with you, Mr. Speaker, Bob Prim, Paul, other members of the state legislature, and other elected officials, Byron McDonald, Helen Root, and our distinguished party officials, my friends of Calhoun County and Michigan. Privileged to have the chance to be here with you tonight, and I must say, I come to Michigan tonight with a mixture of great joy for the fond memories and the great friends and the wonderful experience I've had serving on the Judiciary Committee with your senior senator, and with a bit of sadness in my heart, one, because he is leaving the Senate, and two, because we are not absolutely certain what the future of his health might be. But whatever the future might hold, I want to say to you, as one junior United States Senator who came to the Senate at a time when some might have said he was still wet behind the ears, I don't know another member that I've had the privilege to serve with that has exemplified courage and principle the way Phil Hart has. Miss him in the Senate. We're going to miss him. I have to be very frank with you this evening. I love that introduction of Frank Wilcox. That was a beauty. But I also have to be particularly candid with you in these moments when I think the times demand absolute candor. But as much as I like those words, having just gone through a rather difficult campaign for re-election in Indiana, I have to confess to you that not all the people of Indiana share the assessment that Frank Wilcox has for his spot. A couple of you have heard me tell a story that exemplifies this feeling by a few anyhow. I think it happens to all of us who run for public office, but it was in the closing stages of the campaign, one of those hectic days, you know, when you start off before daylight at Plantgate and you go almost without stopping until the end of the day. It was about 2:30 in the afternoon, and I found myself up in the northern part of our state, and I was making a mad dash, I guess it was Michigan City, over to catch one of those plant shift changes and shake hands with some of the steel workers coming off work over there. And at 2:30, and I had a rather strange sensation about the belt buckle, bud, and I realized there it was, 2:30, and I had no breakfast and I had no lunch. So I suggested to the young man who was driving that he pull in at a Kentucky Fried Chicken stand that I could see on the right up here, and we'd pick up a couple of boxes of Kentucky Fried, eat them en route, and not miss shift change. Well, we went into the place, and there was a nice young man running it, and while he was in the back filling up our orders, a very nice-looking young lady came in. That's the only way to describe her. She was a very nice-looking young lady. And since she was a constituent of mine, I felt duty-bound to introduce myself to her. I stuck out my hand and said, "Hello, I'm Birch Bayh. How are you?" "Fine." We stood there saying absolutely nothing for about 3 minutes, and finally she turned back to me rather indignantly, and she said, "Well, sir," she said, "I'm hungry, and if you're running this place, the least you could do is wait on me." I have to say to you, at that moment, I just hoped she wasn't registered, because I didn't think she was one of ours. One of the things that Frank included in his very thoughtful introduction was my authorship of the 25th Amendment. Now, I have to say to you, as a shirt-tail lawyer from Shirkyville, Indiana, who also does a little farming, or did at a time in his life, still own it, but I don't have much time to get back there. I wish I did. I have to say I was proud to be involved in an amendment to the Constitution. You know, we've only had the 26, and I've been involved in 2, and we hope to be able to ratify a 27th. It's out in the states right now. But I have to say, you in Michigan here, in all candor, you know, thinking in terms of presidential politics, I don't know whether it makes much sense to say, vote for the man who gave us Jerry Ford. The 25th Amendment is what made it possible for us to get out of some very difficult times, as you recall, when we had a president that was, shall we say, below the standard that we would like to have a president attain. So perhaps instead of saying vote for the man that gave us Jerry Ford, we ought to, particularly in Michigan, say vote for the man that got Jerry Ford out of Michigan. or maybe I put him in, so help me get him out. Well, I'm glad to be here. I have fond memories of being with Mark and many of you that I've had a chance to see again. I guess that was when, Mark, back 70, 71, we had a great meeting. And in flying along tonight, I couldn't help but reminisce to myself a little bit about that, and I was looking forward to, and I'm still looking forward to having a chance to visit with some of you I haven't had a chance to say hello to. And I, thinking about how anxious I was to get here, I thought of the story that was told to me by old Senator Carl Hayden, who was the president pro tem of the Senate. When I first went to the Senate, he had been in the Senate about 45 years, about 96 years of age. And to show you how long a period of life, his period of time, his public life transcended, when he first went into public life, he was a county sheriff out in a county in Arizona. And that was before Arizona was the United States. He was really a sheriff in the Wild West Territory. And he told him an experience he had one time. I could just see this elderly gentleman, what he must have looked like riding across the prairie, you know, with the hat and the six-gun. He told about riding into this little one-horse town, just a few buildings on either side. Down at the end was the neighborhood establishment for entertainment and refreshment. And as he got a little closer, he could see a rather grizzled little prospector tying his pack mule up to the hitch rack to go in and wash some of the trail dust out of his throat. And as the old gentleman stepped up on the porch in front of this establishment, why, the door swung open and out staggered a cowboy who obviously had been refreshed a little bit too much. And he saw the prospector and thought he was likely prey, and he pulled out his six gun and pointing it at him, he said, "Say there, young fella, have you ever danced a jig?" And before the old gentleman could answer, he found himself out in the middle of that dirt street jumping up and down as those bullets struck in alarming proximity to those worn out prospector boots, and he could dance a pretty good jig. Well, the old gentleman had never graduated magna cum laude from Michigan, probably never gone to a day of school in his life, but he could count. And when that sixth bullet had been expended, he very calmly, patiently returned to his pack mule, dug around inside, found a shotgun, and put it right under the nose of the cowboy and said, "Say there, young fella, have you ever kissed a mule?" And the cowboy, he scratched his head. He said, "Well, you know, I never have, but I've always wanted to." Well, it's been my privilege to be in Calhoun County, but I've never been in Marshall, but I've always wanted to. So I'm glad to have a chance to be here with you, and it didn't take that kind of intimidation to get me here. I came because of my friendship and my feeling that a man like Mark Gray needs to be recognized by those of us who understand how important it is to get men and women of his caliber in all parties, in all parts of our country, in public life. I think sometimes those of us in Washington sort of get carried away by the federal syndrome. I think even the President of the United States sometimes sits there in that Oval Office and thinks he has all the answers. Frankly, I don't think any one person has all the answers. Hopefully we can, and from time to time we've been able to muster enough good people who really were concerned, cared, that we could have moments of greatness. I suggest we're going to have moments of greatness in the future, but I don't think all of these decisions are ever going to be adequately made, the problem solved, strictly from the federal level. And I have to say, as one who has voted for a number of programs that have been involved in spending a good deal of money, and as hard put as the cities, counties, states are for programs that can help them through the particularly tight times in which we are, and as much as I think this is important, I think just the price tag is not necessarily the final prerequisite for success. I was thinking in terms of the importance of local responsibility, local officials, and local participation. Coming out trying to determine, you know, how, there's no need of me telling you what a good clerk Mark Gray's been. But I think I can tell you, as one member of the United States Senate, how important I feel it is to have men like him and some of the rest of you here who have this responsibility where you are, helping to solve problems at the local level. I found when I went to the state legislature the first time, Paul, I'll say, I think that our inability in the Indiana legislature to confront some of those problems at the state level, and the same for other legislatures around over the country, and I say this about 20 years ago, so that shouldn't indict too many of us here, that our inability to come to grips with some of those problems, I think at least partially responsible for the movement of federal programs, because when a local community can't resolve its problems, it moves to Lansing or to Indianapolis, and when that can't be solved at that level, it goes to Washington. And I found that if we're really going to come to grips with these problems, we need to have an all-out effort at all levels of government. I was thinking of one specific example of Frank mentioned the Juvenile Justice Act. Well, as the chairman of the Juvenile Delinquency Subcommittee, I started examining some time ago just what this juvenile delinquency was. I'd been involved with young people for a long period of time, and I must say I was shocked to find, we're talking about juvenile delinquency and juvenile crime, we're talking about half of all the serious crimes that are committed in America today are committed by young people under the age of 18. Now, I'm not talking about hubcaps and joyrides. I'm talking about serious crimes. And you go back one step further and you see how society responds or refuses to respond to problems that children have. And that you take a 13-year-old girl, for example, that ran away from home and just happened to be El Paso, Texas, put her in jail for 10 months because her mother didn't want anything to do with her. Process, she turned 14 and a legal defense attorney found out about her, started asking some questions. The first one was why she ran away in the first place. Well, she'd run away from home because she was tired of being sexually molested by her stepfather. And that is not a rare experience. Oh, I thought this was just El Paso, Texas. But I must say, when I got to asking some questions, that happened in all too many communities in Indiana. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that kind of thing doesn't also happen in Michigan. We have problems with children who won't go to school, and that's bad, just like I don't recommend running away from home. But society's response all too often for a child that can't cope in the classroom is to send him to boys' school. Here again, I can't speak for Michigan, but I can speak talking to our superintendent of boys' school. The chances of that person really being rehabilitated as a result of that experience is almost nil. That instead of him learning how to read and write arithmetic, you know, he learns how to cross-wire ignition switches and hustle televisions and heroin and the whole business. So what we were trying to do, and what I hope we'll be able to do with this Juvenile Justice Act, is not to respond to the offense, but to try to prevent it. We talk about prevention being worth more than a pound of cure, but there's very little of it cranked in our juvenile justice system. I think society has a right to be concerned when we have people out on the streets preying on them and taking away their freedom and their worldly goods, doing them bodily harm. I don't suggest that young toughs or old toughs ought to be mollycoddled. But if we're ever going to get on top of this crime problem, we have to do more than try to politicize law and order. But we have to deal with human problems at a time when we have a chance to come to grips with them. Let's keep those children in the classroom. Let's find the problems in the home that cause the problems in the school that lead to the problems in the street, to the boys' school, and then on to the penitentiary. And what we tried to do in this act was not to have a federal solution, but to turn around this approach and to send some resources and some programming and to accent the necessity of mobilizing both private and public forces at the local level. We're not going to solve juvenile delinquency. We're not going to solve crime in Washington. You can do it in Calhoun County. We can do it in Terre Haute, Indiana. But it's going to take not only elected officials that are willing to try new approaches, it's going to take a lot of concerned citizens, the big brothers, the big sisters, the foster parents. We could mobilize the people of this country who really care and give them a little guidance. I think then we can take a generation that may be headed for trouble, and we can put them on the positive road so that they become productive members of society. And you know, this has to be resolved at the local level. People like yourselves here, those who are elected and those who aren't, are going to come to grips with this kind of problem. and other kinds of problems. And I said a moment ago, just more money, well, we can solve a lot of problems, I suppose, with the good application of money. And I could give you a big, long speech on the misapplication and the need to reorder our priorities right now. I think that's one of the most important challenges we have at the federal level. I want to say, if you look at the crime situation, if you take it all levels of government, local, state, federal government, last year we spent $14.5 billion, and crime went up 17%. Now, you know, you'd fire the president of a corporation that got no better results than that. Somebody the other day said, well, that might not be a bad idea in Washington, but the question is how we bring these resources to bear more effectively. And hopefully together we can do that. I have been conducting some hearings on the problems of violence and vandalism. Some of our schools are really not the kind of schools that have the environment for broadening educational experience. And I must say, talking about the individual, last week Marion Wright Edelman, who's a very distinguished woman, testified as a result of a study that they had done on children's problems, particularly with the discipline problem. And, you know, she said, Senator, I don't know how anybody in Washington can expect for us to have better discipline in the schools than we have in the homes. And, you know, that's true. So I think in the final analysis, this effort, we talk about crime being a national problem, well, I think it's going to be resolved, this and others, by breaking it down into small enough components that we can come to grips with it in our own home communities. Now, I want to think, if I might, just quickly this evening, about something that I'm really concerned about. Of all the problems, I suppose it's a product of 20 years of public life that causes me to be perhaps more concerned over this problem than any other. It's not much discussed, which makes it a greater problem in my judgment, because as I've traveled around over the country, perhaps some of you sense it here, but I've sensed all over America a rather alarming degree of disenchantment with things in general. I think it's fair to say that millions of Americans have lost faith. They've lost faith in their country. They've lost faith in their political institutions. They've lost faith in their political leaders. Perhaps most significantly, they've lost faith in their capacity to work within the political system to make that system respond to the inequities, grievances, and the problems that are meaningful to them and their family. What concerns me about this is that in a free society, where the people, generally 215 million of us, chart the course for a whole nation, if the people themselves lose faith, if the idealistic, concerned, dedicated citizens drop out of the process, you know who's left to run it. And I must say, I think we have to, together as individuals, and particularly some of us in public life, take the steps necessary to reverse this erosion of faith. I don't know how many people I've talked to. It used to be during the Vietnam War that this was primarily a syndrome of the young. It isn't the young now. When you have some communities where you have as high as 35% unemployment among auto workers, you tell me that doesn't cause disbelief. You have 75-year-old retirees that can't pay the utility bill and are wondering now with the new increase whether they're going to pay the heating bill. That causes disbelief. And there's sort of a feeling that the government really doesn't care. It's a process that's removed from the individual concern that it's supposed to be, me. One of the things that I'm sure you sense here in Michigan, we sense it in Indiana, it's a national problem that I think is at least partially the cause of this, is that the kind of economic climate we find ourselves in right now. Without giving you an economic treatise and without offending some of our Republican friends here, nevertheless, I have to tell you that when you have a government that for an unacceptably long period of time is willing to accept over 8 million people unemployed, there's reason for a number of citizens to wonder who cares. We're not talking about just eight and a half million people unemployed. We're talking about a number of other, millions of other workers who are working on shorter work weeks, which would add up to about a total of 2 million more. Statistics say there are about a million others who have, in frustration, given up. We're talking about a depression or a recession or whatever you might call it, a regression in the industrial capacity of this country, which we're now operating at about 65% of capacity. We're now operating about $200 billion. Imagine that, $200 billion below what we could if we really had all of the wheels of this great industrial power of our country moving. And we've had so many, what seems to me, excuses coming out of high places. Instead of facing up to the problem and seeing what we could do about it, we start first with President Nixon and then President Ford now. The worst is behind us. There's light at the end of the tunnel. We've turned the corner so many times we're dizzy. Now President Ford says we've bottomed out. Well, I'll tell you, to the 8 million people out of work, when you bottom out in the economy, that means you jump off the Empire State Building. You bottom out when you hit the street. That's where we are right now. And it seems to me that one of the things we had to come to grips with is to do away with this old-fashioned idea that in the kind of economy we have right now, with 8 million people out of work, 65% capacity, that energizing those programs to get people put back to work is going to cause inflation. The inflation we have right now, I'm concerned about. But it isn't the old type of inflation of too much money chasing too few goods. It's basically a food and an energy-based inflation. And we just have to get rid of the syndrome in Washington where Bill Simon and Alan Greenspan and some of the rest of them are preaching the gospel that we better not put too many people back to work or we're going to cause inflation. We better turn that philosophy around and say that in this country, with all of our resources, we ought to have a job for every able-bodied man and woman that wants to work. That ought to be... that there isn't work to do. Some 20 million American families are living in substandard housing, and we have well over a half a million construction workers that haven't worked in over a year. Two-thirds of the communities in America need sewage systems. Why don't we put some of these workers to work building these things that people can use? These aren't make-work jobs. We had 800,000 high school dropouts last year. And as I said a moment ago, once that youngster doesn't go to school, that's the first indication that there's trouble. I have a number of unemployed school teachers. Why don't we get that per pupil teacher ratio down to the place? Bring some extra help in there to those kids that have trouble. Let's bring those people in there and put them to work solving other people's problems. It's going to make us all a lot better off, I think, in the final analysis. One of the things I've been trying to do is to deal with the real tragedy of what we've let happen to our railroad system. That's tragic, you know. Now, we have significant unemployment among railroad maintenance workers. And one of the amendments that I've been trying to get through the jobs bill program as part of the CETA program is a funding program to put these railroad maintenance workers back to work. Not only providing jobs for themselves and their family, but keeping this railroad system up and putting it in better shape so it'll make money instead of go bankrupt. Now, that kind of thing. I'm hoping that in the months ahead, if we can change this philosophy, fear of doing too much to put people to work. I have to say to you, I'm concerned about a $70 million deficit, $70 billion deficit. That's terrible. A lot of red ink, isn't it? But when you look at where that came from, and this is what concerns me, because we're not facing up to the facts as they are today. We're living 20 years ago, or else trying to kid somebody. This business of passing the buck, you know, that might make good politics temporarily, but it isn't going to solve any problems. In the final analysis, it's going to be bad politics. That $70 billion is not because of those wasteful Democrats there in Washington throwing that $70 billion in the Potomac River. When you have 8 million people out of work, when you have small business bankruptcies, when you have large corporations operating in the red instead of in the black, they're not paying taxes, and that's where we got into the deficit with a revenue fall off. And if you can go from almost 9% unemployment where we were to a acceptable 4%, and when you look at the ratio for each percent of unemployment, you lose $16 billion worth of revenue, you add that up, and we go from a $70 billion deficit to a surplus, and in the meantime, we have a lot of people providing for themselves, and we have the kind of a healthy economy that we can be proud of in this country. And it seems to me that's the way we need to approach this. This business of high interest rate, tight money, it really concerns me. We get hit with a new wave of inflation, which the economic experts in Washington say is food and energy, and Arthur Burns cranks the interest rate up again and cuts back on the money supply, which means if we're not careful, we're going to take the too little recovery that we see. We're going to take it and we're going to squash it. We're going to flatten it out on an interest rate and a monetary policy that is designed to deal with a different kind of inflation. I'm also very much concerned about what this energy situation is going to amount to. We're having some real differences of opinion between the President and Congress on that. And I must say, I don't know how one says this in polite company, the response I felt when I saw the President signing the continuation of the control measure suggests that really it was the Congress of the United States that was responsible for OPEC raising the price of crude oil. Well, that's going to cost us a little more than a dollar a barrel, and I don't like it. You know, I don't like it a bit to have a few nations that have, most of them having fewer people in the state of Michigan, determining what our energy policy is. But if we're really concerned about inflation and cost of living brought on by energy costs, then we ought to find a way to convince Gerry Ford to take that $2 a barrel excise tax that he put on there by his own unilateral decision, which has been ruled illegal by the federal courts, and which he is now appealing to the Supreme Court of the United States. And if we're really concerning ourselves about price, we better examine what's happening as far as this price control business in Washington, as far as crude oil is concerned. I have to say to you, I don't like price control, and I like free enterprise. Does anybody here believe we have free enterprise in the petroleum industry today?
No way.
You believe in the Easter Bunny? I mean, we can maybe joke about it, but we really, unfortunately, do not have free enterprise competition in the petroleum industry. And we're playing these games of pass the buck politically. The problem gets worse. Basically, the battle is a rather narrowly defined one, if you look at it, where you have the Congress on one side says, we want to control the price of the crude oil that's produced in this country. And we want to control it at $5.25 a barrel. And the President on the other side says, he wants to take that control off and let the price of our own petroleum rise to the international level of about $13.25 or $13.50. And in my judgment, that is totally responsible, and I hope that Congress will stand up and keep those controls on there. Because that's the only... It's very frustrating to see us pass an energy program which... Basically, the difference between the President and the Congress on energy is that he wants the price to be the determinant. And I'd buy that if it was a free market. If we didn't have that OPEC cartel. That's one of the reasons that I'm trying to get this bill of mine passed, which would break up these oil companies. Let's break them up. Let's have some competition out there. And then we'll worry about price. But until we do that, it seems to me rather than let the price be the determinant, let it go to a dollar a gallon as the way we're going to conserve. Let's get some other programs enacted, like some of those that have been passed by the Congress and vetoed by the President. Mandating better efficiency in automobiles. I'm convinced that we can sell just as many automobiles, employ just as many auto workers. The automobile makes 30 miles to the gallon as if it makes 13. But I'm convinced we can save about 30% of our heating supplies in this country just by normally prudent insulation practices. A number of these things we can do to really conserve. The problem is when you just let price do it. That says, you have a big black car and $1 million in the bank, you can drive up to that tank, if it's a dollar a gallon, you can say, fill it up, and you really don't feel it very much. If you've got to drive back and forth to work or to school, or if you're out there on the farm where you need that motor vehicle as a part of your livelihood, that is the segment of our society that has to bear the burden of a price-only energy policy, and in my judgment, that is inequitable and not the kind of policy we ought to have in this country. Well, I think I've got carried away enough here on the economy. I'd like to see a wave of public officials, and I'd like to see presidents and senators and congressmen that are willing to stand up and be counted unequivocally on these tough issues, that were more determined about finding out what was right before they stuck up their finger to see which direction the wind is blowing, to see what's politically popular. I tell you, I think the people of this country are tired of the timid politicians who are looking for the easy, popular way. I think there's a yearning for the return of Louis. Harry Truman says, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, and that's the way it ought to be today.
Amen.
What really distresses me, you know, I love this country. Oh, I can be critical of it. I can be critical of myself and my opponents. But I love this country. You travel from one part to the next, east to west, and you get a panoramic view of all the strengths and all the ideals and all the dreams out there. Right now, because of the lack of leadership or resolve or for whatever reason, there are all too many people, and perhaps an entire country is obsessed with problems. We're obsessed by our weaknesses. That's a very devastating thing. It depresses and recesses our economy. It erodes our resolve. We're almost like the little cartoon figure running around with the gloom cloud. And it seems to me that individually, those of us in public life and individual citizens, have to find a way in which we can start building on our strengths and taking advantage of our weaknesses, of our positive aspects, of our strengths. With all of our weaknesses, we still have the greatest industrial capacity, greatest technological base, greatest agricultural production, greatest free institutions. Greatest for institutions. It seems to me all of us have to do what we can to get involved to a higher degree and get others involved in these institutions to make them work and to make them move this country on to a higher plateau and get us out of these doldrums that we find ourselves in right now. You know, I guess I'm an optimist. I'm a believer. I don't know whether some of you may have had a chance to see The Man from La Mancha or not. One of the few times in the last couple of 3 years where Ella and I have had a chance really to sneak away. We snuck away on her birthday on a weekend and went up to New York and saw Richard Kraft and Kylie in the screenplay off Broadway. And I have to say, unapologetically, when it was over, I had tears running down my cheeks. Men from La Mancha is the story of Don Quixote, as most of you know. Knight of the shining countenance. Reached for the unreachable star, dreamed the impossible dream, who went forth to slay the dragon and protect the maiden on a white horse that was really nothing but an old nag with shining armor, which really was nothing but a pot on his head and a dishpan for a shield and a mop handle for a lance. And he was ridiculed throughout his entire life. And he fought windmills instead of dragons. Dreamer, give me liberty or give me death. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Those were the words of windmill tilters. And because future generations, past generations of Americans, were willing to tilt windmills, future generations of Americans are going to have an opportunity to make that dream real. And we have a responsibility, Democrats, Republicans, individual citizens of the greatest nation on the face of this earth, to do what we can to get this country moving, restore our capacity individually and collectively to dream, and if enough of us really care and enough of us are really willing to devote ourselves to this goal, I believe we can make these dreams come true.